moved in with his grandmother, who was also raising a horde of cousins. He started using crack, then selling it. In spite of a life on the streets, Gerard is a kindly soul with no mean streak. He has no history of violence and no business wasting his life in prison. He's one of a million young blacks being warehoused by the taxpayers. We're approaching 2.5 million prisoners in this country, by far the highest rate of incarceration in any semi-civilized nation. It's not unusual to get a cellie you really don't like. I had one who required little sleep, and he played his iPod throughout the night. He had earphones, which are required after 10 p.m., but the volume was so high I could still hear the music. It took me 3 months to get a transfer. Gerard, though, understands the rules. He told me he once slept in an abandoned car for weeks and almost froze to death. Anything is better than that. Gerard and I begin each day at 6 a.m., when a buzzer wakes us. We dress quickly in our prison work clothes, careful to give each other as much space as our 10-by-12 cell will allow. We make our bunks. He has the top one, and because of my seniority, I have the bottom. At 6:30, we hustle over to the chow hall for breakfast. The chow hall has invisible barriers that dictate where one sits and eats. There is a section for the blacks, one for the whites, and one for the browns. Intermingling is frowned upon and almost never happens. Even though Frostburg is a camp, it is still a prison with a lot of stress. One of the most important rules of etiquette is to respect each other's space. Never cut in line. Never reach for anything. If you want the salt and pepper, ask someone to pass them. Please. At Louisville, my prior home, fights were not unusual in the chow hall, and they were usually started when some jackass with sharp elbows infringed on someone else's space. Here, though, we eat slowly and with manners that are surprising for a bunch of convicted criminals. Out of our cramped cells, we enjoy the wider spaces of the chow hall. There is a lot of ribbing and crude jokes and talk of women. I've known men who spent time in the hole or solitary confinement, and the worst part of it is the lack of social interaction. A few handle it well, but most start cracking up after a few days. Even the worst loners, and there are plenty of them in prison, need people around them. After breakfast, Gerard reports to work as a janitor scrubbing floors. I have an hour of downtime before I report to the library, and this is when I walk over to the coffee room and start reading newspapers. Again today, there appears to be little progress in the faucet investigation. Interestingly, though, his oldest son complained to a reporter from the Post that the FBI is doing a lousy job of keeping the family updated. No response from the FBI. With each passing day, the pressure mounts. Yesterday, a reporter wrote that the FBI was interested in the former husband of Naomi Clary. Their divorce 3 years ago had been contentious, with both parties accusing the other of adultery. According to the reporter, his sources were telling him the FBI had interrogated this ex-husband at least twice. The library is an annex that also houses a small chapel and nurse's station. It is exactly 40 feet long and 30 feet wide, with 4 cubicles for privacy, 5 desktop computers, and 3 long tables where inmates are allowed to read, write, and do research. There are also 10 stacked tiers that hold, at any given time, about 1,500 books, mostly hardbacks. At Frostburg, we are allowed to keep up to 10 paperbacks in our cells, though virtually everyone has more. An inmate may visit the library in his off hours, and the rules are fairly flexible. 2 books per week may be checked out, and I spend half of my time keeping up with past due books. I spend a fourth of my time as a jailhouse lawyer, and today I have a new client, Roman comes to me from a small town in North Carolina, where he owned a pawn shop that specialized in fencing stolen goods, guns primarily. His suppliers were a couple of gangs of coke-crazed idiots who robbed fine homes in broad daylight. Possessing not the slightest hint of sophistication, the thieves were caught in the act, and within minutes were squealing on each other. Roman was soon dragged in and hit with all manner of federal violations. He pleaded ignorance, but it turns out his court-appointed lawyer was without a doubt the dumbest person in the courtroom. I do not claim to be an expert on criminal law, but any green first-year law student could catalog the mistakes made by Roman's lawyer during the trial. Roman was convicted and sentenced to 7 years, and his case is now on appeal. He hauls in his legal papers, the same pile every inmate is allowed to keep in his cell, and we go through them in my little office, a cubicle littered with my personal stuff and off-limits to every other inmate. Roman will not shut up ranting about how bad his defense lawyer was, and it doesn't take me long to agree. IAC, ineffective assistance of counsel, is a common complaint for those convicted at trial, but it's rarely grounds for an appellate reversal in non-death penalty cases. I'm excited by the possibility of attacking the lousy performance of a lawyer who's still out there, still making a living and pretending to be much better than he is. I spend an hour with Roman, and we make an appointment for another meeting. It was one of my early clients who told me about Judge Fawcett. The man was desperate to get out of prison, and he thought I could work miracles. He knew precisely what was in the safe in the basement of that cabin, and he was obsessed with getting his hands on it before it disappeared. Chapter 9. I'm back in the warden's office, and something is up. He's wearing a dark suit, starched white shirt, paisley tie, and his pointed toe cowboy boots are fairly gleaming with fresh wax and polish. He's still smug as ever, but somewhat twitchy. "I don't know what you told them, Bannister," he's saying, "but they like your story. I hate to repeat myself, but if this is your idea of a prank, then you'll pay dearly for it." "It's not a prank, sir." I suspect the warden was eavesdropping next door and knows exactly what I told them. "They sent 4 agents here 2 days ago, snooped all over the place, wanted to know who you hung out with, who you did legal work for, who you played checkers with, where you worked, who you ate with, who you showered with, who you celled with, and on and on." I shower alone. "I guess they're trying to figure out who your buddies are. Is that right?" "I don't know, sir, but I'm not surprised. I figured as much. I knew the FBI was snooping around Frostburg, though I did not see the agents. Secrets are extremely hard to keep in prison, especially when outsiders appear and start asking questions. In my opinion, and based on some experience, it was a clumsy way to dig into my background." "Well, they're back," he says. "They'll be here at 10, and they said it might take some time." It is 5 minutes before 10 a.m. The same sharp pain hits my gut again, and I try to breathe deeply without appearing obvious. I shrug as if it's no big deal. "Who's coming?" I ask. "Hell if I know." Seconds later, his phone buzzes, and his secretary relays a message. We're in the same room adjacent to the warden's office. He, of course, is not present. Agents Hansky and Arardi are back, along with a fierce young man named Dunleavy, an assistant U.S. attorney from the Southern District of Virginia, Roanoke office. I'm gathering steam, gaining credibility and curiosity. My little group of interrogators is looking more impressive. Though Dunleavy is the youngest of the three, he is a federal prosecutor, and the other two are simply federal cops. Therefore, Dunleavy has seniority at this moment and seems rather full of himself. Not an unusual posture for a man in such a position. He can't be more than 5 years out of law school, and I assume he'll do most of the talking. Obviously, Mr. Bannister, he begins with an obnoxious, condescending tone, we wouldn't be here if we didn't have some interest in your little story. Little story. What a prick. Can I call you Malcolm? He asks. Let's stick with Mr. Bannister and Mr. Dunleavy for now, anyway. I respond. I'm an inmate, and I haven't been called Mr. Bannister in years. I kind of like the sound of it. You got it, he snaps, then quickly reaches into a pocket. He pulls out a slender recording device and places it on the table, halfway between me on one side and the three of them on the other. I'd like to record our conversation, if that's okay. And with that, my cause takes a giant leap forward. A week ago, Hansky and Arardi were reluctant to remove their pens and take a few notes. Now the government wants to capture every word. I shrug and say, I don't care. He flips a switch and says, Now, you say you know who killed Judge Fawcett, and you want to swap this information for a ticket out of here. And once out, you want our protection. That the basic structure of the arrangement? You got it, I say, mimicking his own words. Why should we believe you? Because I know the truth, and because you guys are nowhere near it. How do you know this? I just do. If you had a serious suspect, you wouldn't be here talking to me. Are you in contact with the killer? I'm not answering that question. You gotta give us something, Mr. Bannister, something that will make us feel better about this little deal of yours. I wouldn't characterize it as little. Then we'll call it whatever you want. Why don't you explain it? How do you see this big deal happening? Okay. It has to be a secret, highly confidential. We have a written agreement, approved by the U.S. Attorney's offices in both the Northern District where I was prosecuted and sentenced and the Southern District where this investigation is taking place. Judge Slater, who sentenced me, will have to sign off on the agreement. Once we've agreed, then I'll give you the name of the killer. You grab him, investigate him, and when the grand jury indicts him for the murder, I will suddenly be transferred to another prison. Except, I will not be serving any more time. I leave here as though I'm being transferred, but instead I go into your witness protection program. My sentence will be commuted, my record expunged, my name changed, and I'll probably want some plastic surgery to alter my appearance. I'll get new papers, new looks, a nice federal job somewhere, and to boot, I get the reward money. Three stone faces stare at me. Dunleavy finally says, Is that all? That's it. And it's not negotiable. Wow. Dunleavy mumbles as if in shock. I guess you've had plenty of time to think about this. Far more than you. What if you're wrong? What if we pick up the wrong guy, somehow get an indictment, you walk, then we can't prove a case? That'll be your problem. You screw up the prosecution, then it's your fault. Okay, but once we have our man, how much evidence will there be? You have the entire federal government at your disposal. Certainly you guys can find enough evidence once you have the killer. I can't do everything for you. For drama, Dunleavy stands and stretches and paces to one end of the room, as if tortured and deep in thought. Then he returns, takes a seat, glares at me. "I think we're wasting our time here," he says. "A bad bluff delivered lamely by a kid who has no business even being in the room." Hansky, the veteran, lowers his head slightly and blinks his eyes. He can't believe how bad this guy is. Arardi never takes his eyes off me, and I can sense the desperation. I can also feel the tension between the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office, which is not at all unusual. I slowly get to my feet and say, "You're right. We're wasting our time. I'm not meeting with you again until you boys send in someone with more than peach fuzz. I've given you my deal, and the next time we chat, I want Mr. Victor Westlake at the table, along with one of your bosses, Mr. Dunleavy. And if you're in the room, then I'll walk out." With that, I leave. I glance back as I close the door, and Hansky is rubbing his temples. "They'll be back." The meeting could have been scheduled to take place at the Hoover Building on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington. Victor Westlake would have been happy to return home briefly, see the boss, check on his staff, have a nice dinner with his family, and so on. However, the director wanted to take a quick road trip. He needed to get away from the building for a few hours, so he loaded his entourage onto a sleek private jet, one of four controlled by the FBI, and took off for Roanoke, a 40-minute flight. His name was George McTavey, aged 61, a career man and not a political appointee, though his politics currently had him in hot water with the president. According to the relentless gossip inside the Beltway, McTavey was barely hanging on to his job. The president wanted a new director of the FBI. After 14 years, McTavey needed to go. Morale was low inside the Hoover Building, so the gossip went. In the past few months, McTavey rarely passed up a chance to leave Washington, if only for a few hours. And it was almost refreshing to focus on such an old-fashioned crime as murder. He had been fighting terror for 10 years now, and there had yet to be even the slightest hint that Fawcett's death was related to Al-Qaeda or homegrown cells. Gone were the glory days of fighting organized crime and chasing counterfeiters. In Roanoke, a black SUV was waiting at the bottom of the jet staircase, and McTavey and his team were rushed away as if snipers were watching and waiting. A minute later, they rolled to a stop outside the freezer and hustled inside. A field visit by the director had two purposes. The first was to raise the spirits of the task force and let them know that in spite of their lack of progress, their work had the highest priority. The second was to ratchet up the pressure. After a quick tour of the makeshift facilities and a round of handshakes that would have impressed a politician, Director McTavey was led to the largest meeting room for the briefing. He sat next to Victor Westlake, an old friend, and they munched on donuts as a senior investigator gave a windy summary of the latest, which wasn't much at all. McTavey didn't need to be briefed in person. Since the murder, he'd been talking to Westlake at least twice a day.
"Let's talk about this Bannister fellow," McTavey said after half an hour of a dull narrative that was going nowhere. Another report was quickly passed around the table.
"This is the latest," Westlake said. "We started with high school classmates, then moved on to college and law school, and there are no viable suspects, no record of any friends or close acquaintances, of no one, really, who ever crossed paths with Judge Fawcett, no gang members or drug dealers or serious criminals. Next, we tracked down as many of his former clients as possible, though this was difficult because we can't get access to a lot of his old files. Again, no one of interest there.
He did the small-town lawyer gig for about 10 years with two older African-American lawyers, and it was a squeaky clean operation.
Did he do business in Judge Fawcett's court?
McTavie asked. There's no record of him handling a case there. He didn't do much federal work, and besides, he was in the Northern District of Virginia. It's fair to say that Mr. Bannister was not a widely sought-after trial lawyer.
So you believe that whoever killed Fawcett is someone Mr. Bannister met in prison, assuming, of course, we believe he knows the truth?
Correct. He served the first 22 months of his sentence in Louisville, Kentucky, a medium security facility with 2,000 inmates. He had three different cellmates, and he worked in the laundry in the kitchen. He also developed his skills as a jailhouse lawyer and actually helped at least five inmates get out of prison. We have a list of about 50 men he probably knew fairly well, but frankly, it's impossible to know everyone he came into contact with at Louisville. And the same at Frostburg. He's been there for the past 3 years and has served time with 1,000 men.
How long is your list?
McTavie asked. We have about 110 names, give or take, but we don't feel too confident about most of these guys.
How many were sentenced by Fawcett?
6.
So there's no clear suspect in Bannister's prison history?
Not yet, but we're still digging. Bear in mind, this is our second theory. The one that assumes whoever killed the judge was carrying a grudge because of a bad outcome in his court. Our first theory is that it was an old-fashioned murder robbery.
Do you have a third theory?
McTavie asked. The jealous ex-husband of the dead secretary, Westlake replied.
That's not credible, right?
Right.
Do you have a fourth theory?
No, not at this time. Director McTavie sipped his coffee and said,
This is really bad coffee.
Two flunkies at the far end of the room bolted to attention and disappeared in search of something better. Sorry, Westlake said. It was widely known that the director was a serious coffee man, and to provide a brew that didn't measure up was an embarrassment.
And Bannister's background again?
He asked. 10 years, RICO. Got caught up in the Barry Rafko mess a few years back, though he wasn't a big player. He had handled some land deals for Barry and got himself convicted.
So he was not in bed with 16-year-old girls?
Oh, no. That was just our congressman. Bannister appears to be a good guy. Former Marine and all. Just picked the wrong client.
Well, was he guilty?
The jury felt so, as did the judge. You don't get 10 years unless you've screwed up somewhere. Another cup of coffee was placed in front of the director, who sniffed it, then finally took a sip as everyone stopped breathing. Then another sip, and everyone exhaled.
Why do we believe Bannister?
McTavie asked. Westlake quickly passed the buck. Hansky? Agent Chris Hansky was sitting on go. He cleared his throat and dove in.
Well, I'm not sure we believe Bannister, but he makes a good impression. I've interviewed him twice, watched him carefully, and I've seen no signs of deception. He's bright, shrewd, and has nothing to gain by lying to us. After 5 years in prison, it's quite possible he bumped into someone who wanted to knock off Judge Fawcett, or to rob him.
And we really have no idea who this person might be, right?
Hansky looked at Victor Westlake, who said, As of today, that's right. But we're still digging.
I don't like our chances of discovering the identity of the killer based on who Mr. Bannister may have bumped into in prison,
McTavie said, sounding perfectly logical.
We could be chasing dead ends for the next 10 years. What's the downside of cutting a deal with Bannister? Look,
The guy is a white-collar crook who has already served 5 years for criminal activity that seems rather harmless in the scheme of things. Don't you think so, Vic?
Vic was nodding gravely. McTavie pressed on.
So the guy gets out of prison. It's not as though we're releasing a serial killer or a sexual predator. If the guy is right, then this case is solved and we can go home. If the guy is conning us, what's the big deal?
At that moment, no one around the table could envision a big deal.
Who will object to it?
McTavie asked. The U.S. Attorney's Office is not on board, Westlake said.
No surprise there, McTavie said. I'm meeting with the Attorney General tomorrow afternoon. I can neutralize the U.S. Attorney. Any other problems?
Hansky cleared his throat again.
Well, sir, Mr. Bannister insists he will not give us the name until a federal judge signs an order of commutation. I'm not sure how this will work, but the commuting of his sentence will become automatic when the grand jury indicts our mystery guy.
McTavie brushed him off.
We got lawyers to handle all that. Does Bannister have one?
Not that I know of.
Does he need one?
I'll be happy to ask him, Hansky said.
Let's get this deal done, okay?
McTavie said impatiently.
There's a big upside and a small downside. Based on our progress so far, we're due for a break.
Chapter 10. A month has passed since the murders of Judge Fawcett and Naomi Clary. Newspaper reports of the investigation have become shorter and less frequent. The FBI had no comment in the beginning, and after a month of frantic work with nothing to show for it, the task force seems to have vanished now. In the past month, an earthquake in Bolivia, a schoolyard shooting in Kansas, the overdose of one rap star and the detoxification of another have all conspired to divert our attention to more important matters. This is all good news for me. The investigation may appear quiet on the surface, but internally the pressure grows. My worst nightmare is a bold headline announcing the arrest of someone, but that appears less and less likely. The days pass, and I wait patiently. I see clients by appointment only. I meet them at my cubicle in the library. They haul in their legal papers, a stack of assorted pleadings, orders, motions, and rulings that as inmates we have the right to keep in our cells. The COs cannot touch our legal papers. For most of my clients, two appointments will suffice to convince them that there is nothing to be done with their cases. During the first appointment, we review the basics and I go through their papers. Then I'll spend a few hours doing research. During the second appointment, I usually deliver the bad news that they're out of luck. There's no loophole to save them. In 5 years, I have helped 6 inmates gain early release from prison. Needless to say, this adds mightily to my reputation as a masterful jailhouse lawyer. But I caution every new client that the odds are stacked heavily against him. This is what I explain to young Otis Carter, a 23-year-old father of two who'll spend the next 14 months here at Frostburg for a crime that should not have been a crime. Otis is a country boy, a Baptist with a deep faith, a happily married electrician who still cannot believe he's in a federal prison. He and his grandfather were indicted and charged with violating the Civil War Battlefield and Artifact Preservation Act of 1979. As amended in 1983, 1989, 1997, 2002, 2008, and 2010. His grandfather, aged 74 and suffering from emphysema, is in a federal medical center in Tennessee, also serving 14 months. Because of his medical condition, he will cost the taxpayers about $25,000 a month. The Carters were hunting for artifacts on their 200-acre farm adjacent to the Newmarket Battlefield State Historical Park in the Shenandoah Valley, less than an hour from my hometown of Winchester. The farm has been in the family for over 100 years, and from the time he could walk, Otis accompanied his grandfather as he went digging for Civil War relics and souvenirs. Over the decades, his family assembled an impressive collection of mini balls, cannonballs, canteens, brass buttons, pieces of uniforms, a couple of battle flags, and several dozen guns of all varieties. This they had done legally. It is illegal to remove artifacts and relics from a National Historic Landmark, which is federal land, and the Carters were well aware of this law. Their private little museum, in a converted hay barn, was stocked with items they had found on their own property. However, in 2010, the Civil War Battlefield and Artifact Preservation Act was amended again. In response to efforts by preservationists to restrict development near battlefields, some last-minute language was added to a 100-page amendment. It became illegal to dig for relics within 2 miles of the borders of a National Historic Landmark, regardless of whose land one happened to be digging on. The Carters were not informed of the new rules. Indeed, the language was buried so deep in the amendment, virtually no one knew about it. Over the years, the federal agents had harassed Otis's grandfather and accused him of digging on protected land. They periodically stopped by his home and demanded to see his museum. When the law changed, they waited patiently until they caught Otis and his grandfather scouring a wooded area of Carter property with metal detectors. The Carters hired a lawyer who advised them to plead guilty. Criminal intent is no longer required for many federal crimes. Lack of knowledge is no defense. As the victim of the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO, an often misguided and famously flexible federal law, I am keenly interested in the proliferation of the Federal Criminal Code, now at 27,000 pages and counting. The Constitution names only 3 federal offenses: treason, piracy, and counterfeiting. Today, there are over 4,500 federal crimes, and the number continues to grow as Congress gets tougher on crime and federal prosecutors become more creative in finding ways to apply all their new laws. Otis could possibly attack the constitutionality of the amended law. This would take several years of litigation and would drag on long after he's paroled and back home with his family. As I explained this to him during our second meeting, he seems to lose interest. If he can't get out right now, why bother? But the case intrigues me. We decide to discuss it later. If my grand scheme falls flat, I might take Otis's case and fight all the way to the Supreme Court. That will keep me busy for the next 5 years. The Supreme Court has twice refused to consider my case. Though we couldn't prove it, there was a strong feeling that my appeals were hurried through the system because of the government's enthusiasm in putting away Barry Rathko and his Confederates, me included. I was convicted in November 2005 and sentenced 2 months later to 10 years. At my sentencing, I was remanded, which meant I was taken into custody. A few lucky federal felons are allowed to self-surrender or remain free until ordered to report to a facility. They have time to prepare, but most are not given this luxury. My lawyer thought I would get 5 or 6 years. Barry the Backhander, the star defendant, the target, the colorful villain everyone enjoyed hating, got 12 years. Surely I deserved less than half the time of that slime ball. Dion, my beautiful and loving and fiercely supportive wife, was in the courtroom, sitting bravely next to my humiliated father. I was the only one of the eight sentenced that day. And as I stood before Judge Slater, with my lawyer to my right, I had trouble breathing. This cannot be happening, I said to myself, over and over, as I took in the blurred images around me. I don't deserve this. I can explain. I am not guilty. Slater scolded and preached and played for the press, and I felt like a battered heavyweight in the 15th round, sagging on the ropes, covering my face, waiting for the next shot to the face. My knees were putty. I was sweating. When Judge Slater said, 10 years, I heard a gasp behind me as Dion collapsed in tears. As they led me away, I glanced back for the last time. I've seen this 100 times in movies, TV shows, and in real-life court reporting. The last frantic farewell look of the condemned. What do you think about as you're leaving the courtroom and you're not going home? The truth is that nothing is clear. There are too many random thoughts, too much fear, anger, and raw emotion to understand what is happening. Dion had both hands over her mouth, in shock, crying, tears everywhere. My father had his arm around her, trying to console her. That was the last thing I saw. My beautiful wife, distraught and destroyed. Now she's married to someone else. Thanks to the federal government. My jurors came from the district. A few appeared bright and educated, but most were not, shall I say, sophisticated. After 3 days of deliberations, they announced to the judge that they were making little progress, and who could blame them? By unloading a sizable chunk of the federal code, the prosecutors had adopted the time-worn strategy of throwing as much mud as possible against the wall and hoping something would stick. This overkill had turned what should have been a relatively easy case against Barry Ravko and the congressman into a legal quagmire. I had spent countless hours working on my own defense, and I couldn't understand all of the prosecution's theories. From the beginning, my lawyer had predicted a hung jury. After 4 days of deliberations, Judge Slater delivered what is commonly referred to in trial circles as the dynamite charge. This is basically a demand that the jurors get back there and reach a verdict at all costs. You're not going home until we have a verdict. Such a charge rarely works, but I wasn't so lucky. An hour later, the exhausted and emotionally spent jurors returned with unanimous verdicts against all defendants on all counts. It was obvious to me and many others that they did not understand most of the code sections and intricate theories used by the prosecution. One of the jurors was later quoted as saying, "We just assumed they were guilty, or else they wouldn't have been charged in the first place." I used this quote in my appeals, but it apparently went unheard. I watched the jurors carefully throughout the trial, and they were overwhelmed from the opening statements. And why shouldn't they have been? 9 different lawyers gave their versions of what had happened. The courtroom had to be redesigned and renovated to make room for all of the defendants and all their lawyers. The trial was a spectacle, a farce, a ridiculous way to search for the truth. But as I learned, the truth was not important. Perhaps in another era, a trial was an exercise in the presentation of facts, the search for truth, and the finding of justice. Now, a trial is a contest in which one side will win and the other side will lose. Each side expects the other to bend the rules or to cheat, so neither side plays fair. The truth is lost in the melee. 2 months later, I returned to the courtroom for the sentencing. My lawyer had requested that I be allowed to self-surrender, but Judge Slater was not impressed with our request. After he gave me 10 years, he ordered me into remanded custody. It is indeed remarkable that more federal judges are not shot. For weeks afterward, I conceived all manner of schemes to inflict a slow, torturous death upon Slater. I was taken to the courtroom by the U.S. Marshals and led to a holding cell in the courthouse, then to the D.C. jail, where I was stripped, searched, given an orange jumpsuit, and placed in a crowded cell with 6 other inmates. There were only 4 cots. The first night, I sat on the concrete floor, just me and my thin blanket with holes in it. The jail was a noisy zoo, overcrowded and understaffed, and sleep was impossible. I was too frightened and too stunned to close my eyes, so I sat in a corner and listened to the yells and screams and threats until dawn. I stayed there a week, eating little, sleeping little, urinating in a filthy open toilet that didn't flush and was within 10 feet of my cellmates. At one time, there were 10 of us in the cell. I never showered. A bowel movement required an urgent plea to visit the shit room down the hall. The transporting of federal prisoners is done by the U.S. Marshals, and it is a nightmare. Prisoners of all security levels are lumped together, with no regard for our crimes or the risks we might pose. Therefore, we were all treated like savage murderers. With every movement, my hands were cuffed, my ankles chained, and I was attached to the inmate in front of me and the one behind. The mood is nasty. The marshals have one job, to move the inmates safely with no escapes. The inmates, many of them rookies like me, are frightened, frustrated, and bewildered. 14 of us left D.C. on a bus, an unmarked rig that had hauled school children decades earlier and headed south. The handcuffs and chains were not removed. A marshal with a shotgun sat in the front seat. After 4 hours, we stopped at a county jail in North Carolina. We were given a wet sandwich and allowed to urinate behind the bus, still chained and bound. The handcuffs and leg irons were never removed. After 2 hours of waiting, we left with 3 additional prisoners and headed west. For the next 6 days, we stopped at county jails in North Carolina, Tennessee, and Alabama, picking up prisoners, occasionally dropping one off, sleeping in a different cell each night. The county jails were the worst. Tiny, cramped cells with no heat, air conditioning, sunlight, or suitable sanitation. Food that dogs would ignore. Little water. Bubbas for guards. A much higher threat of violence. Local inmates who resented the intrusion of federal prisoners. I could not believe conditions so deplorable existed in this country, but I was naive. As our journey continued and our mood soured, there was a marked increase in the level of bitching on the bus. This ceased when a veteran inmate explained the concept of diesel therapy. Complain or make trouble, and the marshals will keep you on the bus for weeks and give you a free tour of dozens of county jails. There was no hurry. The marshals can transport prisoners during daylight hours only. Thus, the distances tend to be short. They had absolutely no interest in our comfort or privacy. We eventually made it to a distribution center in Atlanta, a notoriously bad place where I was kept in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day while my paperwork inched across someone's desk in Washington. After 3 weeks of this, I was losing my sanity. Nothing to read, no one to chat with, terrible food, bad guards. Eventually, we were reshackled and loaded onto another bus and driven to the Atlanta airport, where we boarded an unmarked cargo plane. Chained to a hard plastic bench and sitting knee to knee, we flew to Miami, though we had no idea where we were headed. One of the marshals kindly informed us. In Miami, we picked up a few more, then flew to New Orleans, where we sat in suffocating humidity for an hour as the marshals loaded on even more. On the plane, we were allowed to talk, and the chatter was refreshing. Most of us had just endured days of solitary, so we plunged into conversation. This was not the first trip for some of the boys, and they told other stories of being transported in chains, courtesy of the federal government. I began to hear descriptions of prison life. At dark, we arrived in Oklahoma City, where we were shuffled onto a bus and taken to another distribution center. The place was not quite as bad as Atlanta, but by then, I was thinking about suicide. After 5 days in solitary confinement, we were reshackled and taken back to the airport. We flew into Texas, world capital of lethal injection, and I daydreamed of seeing the needle stuck into my arm and floating away. 8 tough guys, all Hispanic, boarded Con Air in Dallas, and we flew to Little Rock, then Memphis, then Cincinnati, where my flying days ended. I spent 6 nights in a tough city jail before a pair of marshals drove me to the prison in Louisville, Kentucky. Louisville is 500 miles from my hometown of Winchester, Virginia. Had I been allowed to self-surrender, my father and I would have made the drive in about 8 hours. He would have dropped me off at the front gate and said goodbye. 44 days, 26 of them in solitary. Too many stops to remember. There is no logic in this system and no one cares. No one is watching. The real tragedy of the federal criminal system is not the absurdities. It is the ruined and wasted lives. Congress demands long, harsh sentences, and for the violent thugs, these are appropriate. Hardened criminals are locked away in U.S. pens, fortresses where gangs are rampant and murders are routine. But the majority of federal prisoners are nonviolent, and many are convicted of crimes that involved little, if any, criminal activity. For the rest of my life, I will be regarded as a criminal, and I refuse to accept this. I will have a life freed from my past and far away from the tentacles of the federal government. Chapter 11. Rule 35 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure provides the only mechanism for the commutation of a prison sentence. Its logic is brilliant and fits my situation perfectly. If an inmate can solve another crime, one that the feds have an interest in, then the inmate's sentence can be reduced. Of course, this takes the cooperation of the investigating authorities, FBI, DEA, CIA, ATF, and so on, and of the court from which the inmate was sentenced. If all goes as planned, I may soon have the privilege of seeing the Honorable Judge Slater, and it will be on my terms. The feds are back. The warden is much nicer to me these days. He figures he has a prize that some big people desire, and he needs to be in the thick of things. I take a seat at his desk, and he asks if I want coffee. This offer is almost too surreal to comprehend. The almighty warden offering coffee to an inmate. "Sure," I say. "Black." He punches a button and relays our wishes to a secretary. I notice he's wearing cufflinks today. A good sign.
Got the big boys here today, Mal.
He informs me smugly, as if he's coordinating all efforts to find the murderer. Since we are such good pals now, he's using my first name. Until now, it's been Bannister this and Bannister that.
Who?
I ask.
The director of the task force, Victor Westlake, from Washington, and a bunch of lawyers. I'd say you have their attention.
I cannot keep from smiling, but only for a second.
This guy who killed Judge Fawcett, was he ever here at Frostburg?
The warden asks.
Sorry, warden. I can't answer that. Either here or Louisville, I take it.
Maybe. Or maybe I knew him before prison. He frowns and rubs his chin.
I see, he mumbles.
The coffee arrives on a tray, and for the first time in years, I drink from a cup not made of plastic or paper. We kill a few minutes talking about nothing. At 11:05, his secretary informs him through the intercom on his desk, "They are in place." I follow him through the door and into the same conference room. 5 men in the same dark suits, same white shirts with button-down collars, same bland ties. If I had seen them in a crowd from half a mile away, I could have said, "Yep, feds." We go through the usual stiff introductions, and the warden reluctantly excuses himself. I sit on one side of the table, and my 5 new buddies sit on the other. Victor Westlake is in the middle, and to his right are Agent Hansky and a new face, Agent Sasswater. Neither of these two will say a word. To the left of Westlake are the 2 assistant U.S. attorneys, Mangrum from the Southern District of Virginia and Craddock from the Northern. The rookie Dunleavy got left behind. Thunderstorms had rolled through just after midnight, and Westlake begins by saying,
"Quite a storm last night, huh?"
I narrow my eyes and stare at him.
"Seriously? You want to talk about the weather?"
This really pisses him off, but he's a pro. A smile. A grunt. Then,
"No, Mr. Bannister. I'm not here to talk about the weather. My boss thinks we should make a deal with you. So that's why I'm here."
"Great." And yes, it was quite a storm.
"We'd like to hear your terms."
"I think you know them. We use Rule 35. We sign an agreement, all of us, in which I give you the name of the man who killed Judge Fawcett. You pick him up, investigate him, do your thing. And when a federal grand jury indicts him, I walk. That very day, I transfer out of Frostburg and disappear into witness protection. No more time, no more criminal record, no more Malcolm Bannister. The deal is confidential, locked away, buried, and signed by the Attorney General."
"The AG?"
"Yes, sir. I don't trust you or anyone in this room. I don't trust Judge Slater or any other federal judge, prosecutor, assistant prosecutor, FBI agent, or anybody else working for the federal government. The paperwork must be perfect. The deal unbreakable. When the killer is indicted, I walk. Period."
"Will you use an attorney?"
"No, sir. I can handle that."
"Fair enough."
Mangrum suddenly produces a file and removes several copies of a document. He slides one across the table, and it comes to a rest in front of me in perfect position. I glance at it, and my heart begins to pound. The heading is the same as all of the motions and orders filed in my case. In the United States District Court of Washington, D.C., United States of America versus Malcolm W. Bannister. In the center of the page, in all caps, are the words, Rule 35 Motion.
This is a proposed court order, Mangrum says. It's just a starting point, but we've spent some time on it.
2 days later, I am placed in the rear seat of a Ford SUV and driven away from Frostburg, my first exit from the camp since the day I arrived 3 years earlier. No leg chains today, but my wrists are cuffed in front of me. My two buddies are U.S. Marshals, names withheld, but they are nice enough. After we get through the weather, one of them asks if I've heard any good jokes. Lock away 600 men and give them plenty of idle time, and the jokes come in waves. Clean or dirty? I ask, though there are few clean jokes in prison.
Oh, dirty, of course, the driver says.
I tell a couple and get some good laughs as the miles fly by. We're on Interstate 68, zipping through Hagerstown, and the feeling of freedom is exhilarating. In spite of the handcuffs, I can almost taste the life out there. I watch the traffic and dream of owning and driving a car again, of going anywhere. I see fast food restaurants at the interchanges, and I salivate at the thought of a burger and fries. I see a couple walking hand in hand into a store, and I can almost feel the touch of her flesh. A beer sign in the window of a bar makes me thirsty. A billboard advertising Caribbean cruises takes me to another world. I feel as if I've been locked up for a century. We turn south on Interstate 70 and are soon in the Washington-Baltimore sprawl. 3 hours after we leave Frostburg, we arrive in the basement of the federal courthouse in downtown D.C. Inside the building, the handcuffs are removed. I proceed with one marshal in front of me, the other behind. The meeting takes place in the chambers of Judge Slater, who's as prickly as ever and seems to have aged 20 years in the past 5. He considers me a criminal and barely acknowledges my presence. Fine. I don't care. It is evident that a lot of conversations have taken place between his office, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, and the Attorney General of the United States. At one point, I count 11 people around the table. The Rule 35 motion, with the attached agreement, has increased in size and runs for 22 pages. I have read every word 5 times. I even demanded some of my own language. The agreement, in short, gives me everything I want: freedom, a new identity, government protection, and the reward money of $150,000. After the usual throat clearing, Judge Slater takes charge.
We will now go on the record, he says,
and his court reporter begins her stenography.
Even though this is a confidential matter and the court's order will be sealed, I want a record of this hearing.
A pause as he shuffles papers.
This is a motion by the United States for Rule 35 relief. Bannister, have you read this entire motion, agreement, and proposed order?
I have, Your Honor.
And I believe you are an attorney, or shall I say, were an attorney.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Does the motion, agreement, and order
meet your approval.
Damn right it does, old boy.
Yes, sir.
He goes around the table and asks the same questions. It's all a formality because everyone has already agreed. And most important, the Attorney General has signed the agreement.
Slater looks at me and says, "You understand, Mr. Bannister, that if the name you provide does not lead to an indictment, then the agreement is null and void after 12 months. Your sentence will not be commuted, and you will serve the remaining time in full."
"Yes, sir."
"And that until there is an indictment, you will remain in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons?"
"Yes, sir."
After more discussion about the terms of the agreement, Judge Slater signs the order and the hearing is over. He does not say farewell, and I do not curse him the way I'd like to. Again, it's a miracle that more federal judges are not whacked. I am swarmed by an entourage and led down the stairs to a room where more dark suits are waiting. A video camera has been set up for my benefit, and Mr. Victor Westlake is pacing. I am asked to sit at the end of the table, face the camera, and offered something to drink. It's a very nervous bunch, desperate to hear me utter the name.
Chapter 12. His name is Quinn Rucker, black male, aged 38, from Southwest D.C., convicted 2 years ago of distributing narcotics and sentenced to 7 years. I met him at Frostburg. He walked away about 3 months ago and has not been seen since. He comes from a large family of drug dealers who've been active and successful for many years. These are not street dealers by any means. They are businessmen with contacts up and down the East Coast. They try to avoid violence, but they are not afraid of it. They are disciplined, tough, and resourceful. Several have gone to prison. Several have been killed. To them, that's just part of the overhead. I pause, take a breath. The room is silent. At least five of the dark suits are taking notes. One has a laptop and has already pulled up the file on Quinn Rucker, who had made several cuts and was on the FBI's top 50 list of suspects, primarily because of his time with me at Frostburg and his escape from it. As I said, I met Quinn at Frostburg, and we became friends. Like a lot of inmates, he was convinced I could file a magic motion and get him out, but not in his case. He was not doing well in prison because Frostburg was his first gig. This happens to some of the new guys who have not seen other prisons. They don't appreciate the camp atmosphere. Anyway, as his time dragged on, he got restless. He couldn't imagine doing 5 more years. He has a wife, a couple of kids, cash from the family business, and a lot of insecurities. He was convinced some of his cousins were moving in, taking over his role.